This is the Takeaway Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. We are watching the developments in the John Kerry efforts to get a deal on Syria to stick. Many ways for this tentative deal on chemical weapons to come unstuck, but we will explore what is solid and what is fragile, even perhaps wishful thinking about this deal a little later this hour. Also, we'll explore the concrete ceiling for the career of one Lawrence Summers, former president of Harvard, former Treasury Secretary, the man with the golden resume who made enemies of the Winklevoss twins, a few million women, and apparently some members of Congress along the way. He will not be chairman of the Federal Reserve. Also, the historic flash flood terror and destruction in Colorado. But we begin in a high-ceilinged room with towering chandeliers, seven-foot windows, a fireplace, and some very old portraits of famous Supreme Court justices. In that room last week, I found myself face-to-face with an intellectual giant who came in a very small package. Supreme Court Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, all 80 years of her and not much more than 80 pounds of her, sat down at the Supreme Court and gave us 30 minutes in the famous Lawyer's Lounge, the room where lawyers giving oral arguments get to spend a little time either cooling or cooking their nerves, thinking about what they're going to say before the nine justices when they present their case. Ginsburg spoke about many things to us, and we will hear the full interview in two parts today and tomorrow, but we especially wanted her thoughts on the role of Congress when the president acts as commander-in-chief and orders the U.S. military into action. Ginsburg says under Article 1 and Article 2 of the Constitution, Congress is all-powerful, even if it sometimes doesn't seem that way, when the president is threatening or even ordering a military strike.
I think almost always with Congress's approval, if not a formal vote, tacit approval, Congress could always stop the president if Congress thinks that what the president has done exceeds the president's authority or is just wrong for the United States. You can go back further in time to what I consider to have been a very wrong judgment. It was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's executive order that people of Japanese ancestry were to be removed from their homes on the West Coast and placed in detention centers. There was no law that authorized that. And Congress certainly knew what had happened and did nothing to stop it, let it go on. So I think there's a shared responsibility, whether Congress takes formal action or not, for when the United States is acting in the interest of national security.
Justice Ginsburg reminded us that it's what Congress doesn't do that is often more important than what it does in cases of national security, and particularly as the debate over what to do about Syria shifts from one end of Pennsylvania Avenue to the other. At a moment when political institutions in Washington are lacking credibility, Justice Ginsburg actually spoke with reverence about the court. Being a Supreme Court justice, she told us, is a remarkable place from which to view the operations of the U.S. government. She was very candid in her interview with us, her answers as sharp as when she was a legendary litigator in the 70s and 80s, just as she is not shy today on the bench, with a reputation as being one of the more vocal justices during oral arguments.
I do ask questions. I think we have an obligation to put to the lawyers the points on which we think the case may turn, so they have their best shot at answering. It's great to be in the position of asking questions and not having to answer questions. I know many a lawyer would like to respond to our question with another question, but that's not cricket.
So many people in America today think of the American government, the legislature, the executive, the presidency on some level, our political system, to be broken or frustratingly divided and incapable of moving forward on issues of our day. Lots of people describe that as the government being broken. People did not describe the judiciary as being broken. What's it like to work in an institution in a frustrating moment in the history of Washington that does work, an institution that absolutely carries out its mission and does what it's supposed to do?
One aspect of appellate judging is we have to give reasons for all of our decisions. And when you sit down and try to write it out, sometimes you find that your first judgment wasn't the right one. And to make the institution work, people have to put aside their own egos and work for the good of the court. We all revere this institution, and we all want to leave it in as good shape as we found it. The current court is unusually collegial. You might not get that impression from some of the 5-4 decisions, but they surely are. That has not always been so. When Justice Brandeis was appointed by President Wilson, his immediate predecessor, McReynolds, also a Wilson appointee, would leave the room when Brandeis spoke because he was an out-and-out anti-Semite. The year Brandeis joined the court, there was no group photograph. McReynolds refused to stand next to Brandeis, so there have been times, there have been justices who just didn't get along with each other, but there's none of that on this court. We all respect and even like each other.
Thinking about your career, and it's, of course, wrong to try to link specific personal histories with legal decisions, but in general, the way in which you were treated in academia and in the law firms that didn't give you an offer, for instance, after you graduated from law school, was a change in the way that women were treated in the legal profession and in the judiciary. Did that change in your life ultimately reflect a change in the law, and you were responsible for so many decisions that changed discrimination law for women? I'm wondering, for a woman or a lawyer starting out today, how one should look at changes they see around them, unfairness they see around them, and how that can translate into actually changing the Constitution in the way that you did in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
I didn't change the Constitution. The equality principle was there from the start. I just was an advocate for seeing its full realization. The Declaration of Independence starts out, all men are created equal. So I see my advocacy as part of an effort to make the equality principle everything the founders would have wanted it to be if they weren't held back by the society in which they lived, and particularly the shame of slavery. So I don't think my efforts would have succeeded had it not been for the women's movement that was reviving in the United States and more or less all over the world at the time. And the court was certainly aware of that sea change in what the public thought women ought to be doing. A great constitutional law scholar, Paul Freund, once said, "The court should never be influenced by the weather of the day, but inevitably they will be influenced by the climate of the era." And that's what happened in the 1970s. Judges had daughters and granddaughters, and they began to recognize that some of the so-called favors for women were not favors at all, but they were locking women into a small piece of man's wide world. So it was the change in society that opened the court's eyes and made my arguments palatable when they would not have been a generation before.
Would you say today that climate is technology and privacy law and the changes that are taking place in the way people communicate and how that affects the First Amendment and law enforcement and the Fourth Amendment, for instance?
Yes, there are just a host of problems spawned by the electronic age, things we couldn't even conceive of. I was amused by the analogy that Justice Scalia made in a case about a GPS tracker. So you don't know that's being done to your car. Is that a violation of your right to protection against unreasonable searches and seizures? So Justice Scalia imagined a constable clinging to the bottom of a carriage as it went on its way. So there was some notion that there is an official eye that's on you, but you don't know about it. Yes, there are all kinds of challenges. And as de Tocqueville said, sooner or later, in the United States, every controversy ends up in court. I think that says great things about our judicial system, or even the cases that I brought. Take the very first one, Sally Reed, who attacked an Idaho statute that said, as between persons equally entitled to administer a decedent's estate, males must be preferred to females. Well, Sally wanted to administer the estate of her 17-year-old son, who was a suicide. When he was staying with his father, he took one of his father's many rifles and killed himself. And the father put in an application, and the probate judge said, Sally, and the law tells me what I must do. Even though you filed first, males must be preferred to females. That woman, who made her living by caring for elderly and infirm people in her own home, she thought that a wrong had been done to her and that the legal system would make it right. So she brought that case with a lawyer from Boise, Idaho, through three levels of the Idaho courts. Every one of the plaintiffs in the cases that I litigated in the 70s was just like that, an everyday person who thought that they had experienced a wrong and that the courts would make it right. It says a lot about the federal judiciary.
On a completely different subject, you've cited Justice Scalia, who we understand is your friend and shares your love of opera. It's often said that at a certain point in a justice's career, there's a kind of question always hanging in the room of when do you hang it up, that sort of thing. Who do you think, in your view, are better at deciding when it's time to quit, opera singers or justices?
I don't like to pigeonhole people or give categorical answers. There are some singers that know exactly when to go, and others hang on much too long. And that is the same with judges. My own view, and I've said this many times, is as long as I can do the work full steam, I will stay on the court. But when I feel myself slipping, when I forget the names of cases that I once could recite at the drop of a hat, I will know.
Tomorrow, more of my interview with Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on her celebrated cases and opinions and why she believes the Second Amendment is virtually obsolete. This is The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The United States and Russia on the same page over Syria, could it be? How long will it last? Russia and the U.S. have a deal to destroy Syria's chemical weapons under United Nations supervision, requiring Syria's complete accounting of its arsenal within a week. International inspectors will then destroy weapons by the end of November with the goal of complete elimination of Syria's chemical arsenal by the first half of 2014. Today in Paris, Secretary of State John Kerry met with his French and British counterparts and presented a united front standing behind this plan.
Our three countries are united and determined to use our full weight as permanent members of the United Nations Security Council and as each other's close allies to implement the agreement on Syria's chemical weapons.
Speaking for the three, that's British Foreign Secretary William Hague alongside French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Can a deal like this among leaders of the international community work with Syria's President Assad and the Syrian opposition in the background, in a sense? With us on the line is Dr. Amar al-Azam, Associate Professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University and a member of the Syrian opposition. Professor, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about who's going to have to actually implement this deal, because as John Kerry would have us believe, Assad will do whatever the Russians say? And is it the case that the opposition will do whatever this international coalition suggests?
Well, I mean, this is really very fraught already, and the chances of this process unraveling is a reality here. For starters, as you quite rightly pointed out, you're relying on Assad to actually come through, and Assad and his regime have basically a long history of not being trustworthy, of having lied to the international community on numerous occasions, not just in relation to the current events that have happened in Syria, but even previously. If one might just point out and remind our listeners that this is the same regime that was also sending jihadis and stoking up the fires of the insurgency and the sectarian fighting in Iraq only a few years before that, and completely lied about that too, as well as lying and trying to cover up the fact that they had chemical weapons and saying they didn't have them when we knew all along that they had them. So this is going to be very difficult because you're relying on the Assad, to be honest. You're also relying on a very unstable situation in Syria. Let's say supposedly that the regime does disclose where all these weapons are in the list as they are required by the agreement being drafted right now, where they have to submit this information within a week. You're also having to rely on the fact on the ground that there won't be that the various factions fighting out there will not impede or that they won't be, and the safety of those inspectors is at stake here. And I think this is something going to be very difficult to guarantee. And these are the very factors that the regime will rely on to try and slow down the process and avoid it. So, you know, you'll have your inspectors there. They'll want to go out to visit a site. And then, on the morning of the visit, there'll be maybe a stray bullet or a sniper possibly planted by the regime. Or just the fact that they have to drive through a military zone or a battlefield line, front line, and then everything's cooled off. And it's going to be very, very difficult to hold this together.
Well, and as you know, the inspectors have been fired upon in the past in preparing even the current report that's about to be delivered. Dr. Amar al-Azam, though, one could turn the tables on the opposition and suggest as well that nothing short of basically regime change, taking out Assad, would be acceptable to the opposition. They seem to have made that point perfectly clear. And so their inclination to cooperate on this agreement is dubious.
Well, again, their willingness to cooperate. I mean, the chemical weapons is one of the worst and most deadly aspects and elements of the Assad regime. So eliminating those, taking those out, is a good thing for everyone, including the opposition. Even as you quite rightly stated, the purpose of the opposition is to remove the Assad regime. Now, but you have to put this into the wider context. Remember that in his address to the nation last week, President Obama said the purpose of the strike was twofold. One, deterring the use of chemical weapons. But two, he said, and degrading Assad's capabilities. And it's this degradation of capabilities that has us most concerned here. And this is what is also concerning the opposition, which is why yesterday they issued a press statement asking that this agreement not only include the chemical weapons, but also delivery mechanisms. That is the ballistic long-range missiles, the heavy artillery, and the aircraft that are used to drop these chemical weapons. And this is an important component that people aren't talking about. Okay, you take the chemicals out, but what about the delivery mechanisms, because you can always make new chemicals. So really, if you want to really deter the Assad regime from using chemical weapons and also fulfill the two requirements that were mentioned by the president's address, that is to deter the use and degrade his capabilities, then you also have to take out the delivery mechanism. And this part has not been included, and that's where everyone's concerned.
Quickly, Dr. Amar al-Azam, does Russia have leverage here over Assad?
Well, again, this is very, very, the leverage is there as long as the interests are coinciding. Assad's primary interest is to survive. So anything that comes his way that helps him survive is going to be used by him. And if it suddenly starts to conflict with his survival, then he's going to cut his own path out of it. And right now we have a complete, crossing over between the survival of the Assad, the interest of the Russians and the Soviet, the Russian regime and the Iranians and the Assad regime to survive are all coinciding. And that's why this is all working out.
Dr. Amar al-Azam is an associate professor of Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University and a member of the Syrian opposition. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Today on The Takeaway, a bike contest on the radio. You'll learn more about the rules of this contest later this hour and how to participate. But we're asking you, what does your bicycle say about you? Sean from Detroit. I have multiple bicycles, road, cyclocross, mountain, single speed, cruisers, and a tandem. They say I value bicycles more than my car. One of you in Oregon gave us this. My bike is light, fast, and efficient, just like me, and it is red. I have red hair, so it's a statement of myself, too.
This is Jane from Morris Plains, New Jersey. My metro-style county bike is Robin's Egg Blue with a wicker basket. It suggests a sense of humor while acknowledging that my Trek racing bike days are long over.
Nonsense, Jane. From Anoka, Minnesota, here's one of you. I have a Towny Bright Orange Pearl. The pedals are forward a bit. It has a fairly comfortable seat with seven gears. It screams, middle-aged woman. What does your bike say about you? Participate in the Takeaway Bike Challenge.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. How to make the problem of homelessness more visible without turning people off. It's the mission of artists Christopher Hope and Kenji Nakayama. Their Signs for the Homeless Project invites artists in Massachusetts to give handwritten cardboard signs of the local homeless a colorful makeover. You might think the last thing a homeless person would need is a colorful new sign, but co-founder Christopher Hope says the project is meant to start a serious dialogue on what might actually end homelessness.
Most people who live in urban areas that pass by or, you know, they're in their cars going through traffic and they might see a gentleman or a lady with a sign, they typically, you know, might just drive right past that person or even walk right past that person. And they might see the sign and think about it for a split second and then that's it. But with what Kenji and I are doing is creating an invitation for a conversation to occur. And so that juxtaposition of this really artful sign is intriguing, but it also brings out curiosity in many passerbyers and many people that pass by. They ask questions. They say, hey, where did you get that sign? And many of the signs, if you've noted in your own experience, and as I've noted in mine, some of them aren't necessarily soliciting for money. Many of them are making a political statement. Some of them are making a religious statement. And so we look at this as an opportunity to use art as an invitation for conversation.
Have you seen that happen? Have you seen those conversations begin?
We have. And many of the participants, they tell us, they tell me how conversations have happened. And not only conversations, but in those conversations, potential job offers. And so many of the participants tell me these stories and tell me also there's a sense of pride that they get that something that they wrote originally on a Sharpie pen on a cardboard has now, you know, been reinterpreted and translated into this really nice artful design.
Have any of these folks said to you, you know what, I really don't necessarily need to be a part of a, you know, Harvard looking kind of art project. What I need is a home. And I like what you're doing, but maybe get a little more concrete.
Right. As far as some of the criticisms, though, that this has not done enough. This project is not grant funded. This is literally between Kenji and myself. We're spending our own money, our own time, our own resources to really help these individuals and to do what we can. Like I said, in addition to the money that we actually pay them to be a participant of the project, we're also, you know, as far as myself, I'm actively following up with them. And for example, one of the participants is currently applying for housing, public housing, and part of their application required a reference. And so their participation in this project allowed me to, you know, give a positive glowing reference for them to potentially get housing. So we're doing all that we can. We're encouraging people to continue to support what we're doing and to see the bigger picture and bigger vision so that potentially even more help can come, whether that be in spreading this movement in other cities around the country, around the world, in addition to potential resources and funding.
And you're convinced that people who participate in this project go from being statistics, numbers, or invisible
to being actual human beings with stories who have a chance to get a place in a real community?
I do. I do. And America and the world has unfinished business with poverty and homelessness, John. And this art project is just one aspect of it. And is hopefully continuing to inspire minds around the world, around this country. And as we continue this unfinished work, we also want to clear and usher in a new horizon of hope through the dark and stormy clouds of desperation and homelessness.
Chris Hope is an advocate for the homeless and co-collaborator on the project Signs for the Homeless. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you so much, John.
We now turn to Colorado, a state changed forever from ruthless mountain floods as the mountains absorb torrential rains in 15 counties across the state. Larimer and Boulder counties have so far been the hardest hit. Larimer County Sheriff Justin Smith spoke to reporters on Sunday.
Rivers developed out of nowhere. I mean, we're talking things that were 8, 10 feet deep, cuts through mountainsides. There's the potential that people got caught up where it felt safe, it was always safe. They may have lived here 20 years, and in no rainstorm have they ever seen water come down.
4 additional inches of rain were recorded on Sunday, grounding military helicopters crucial to the relief effort. The state has reported 6 fatalities. This morning, Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper told NBC's Today Show he expects there will be more. And that's because the Colorado Office of Emergency Management has estimated that more than 1,200 people are unaccounted for, as many remain trapped or unable to get in touch with friends and family. That number is expected to drop as some displaced residents are able to contact officials over the next 24 hours. But more rain is forecast for today. Joining us now is Kirk Mitchell, reporter for the Denver Post. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, John.
So this is terrible. Boulder will never look the same as a result of all this. Where do things stand?
There have been the biggest effort today is to try to reach all the 1,200 plus people that still are unaccounted for. They could be in remote cabins or homes in the mountains. And the roads are washed out, so it's nearly impossible to reach them. And yesterday the helicopters were grounded, so today, in the right circumstances, they're hoping to get up in the mountains and check addresses to see if everybody is okay.
Remind us how this kind of a flood, catastrophe, is so different from the floods in a sort of flat river zone like the Red River or the Mississippi River.
Well, you have the mountains collect all the rain, and they funnel it to channels or canyons, and so there's a lot of area where the rain falls, but when it channels down these canyons, it roars. It could be like a tiny little creek that just trickles, and all of a sudden it's a river. And in many cases, the rivers have jumped their banks, and they've formed new channels. And they've gouged the rock, and they pick up huge pine trees and boulders, and it comes shooting down the mountain. These are very steep mountains, very rugged around Boulder, and normally it's great to have a house right beside a pretty little stream, but then when they become rivers, they'll take those homes and just demolish them. And one tragedy that we learned about yesterday was an 80-year-old woman. She was injured, and she was calling for help, calling family. And before they could reach her, the house was just simply gone. She was swept down the river, is what people believe, and they haven't found her yet. So what the governor was referring to when, you know, they're searching, trying to find people that are 1,200 people that are on that unaccounted for list, and today they're also focused on rebuilding roads, or at least clearing them so that emergency vehicles can reach towns like Jamestown, where there was another fatality. Home was just crushed by boulders and logs that came streaming down one of these river creeks that turned into a river.
And the irony is, of course, that any infrastructure that's created for drainage sometimes turns out to be a problem because you can't really predict how the rivers and all this rainwater and runoff is going to actually go. It may go in completely different directions than is predicted. Kirk Mitchell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kirk Mitchell is a reporter for the Denver Post, author of The Spin Doctor, reporting on the historic flooding taking place in 15 counties in Colorado.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
He's an economics expert and a lightning rod, and he is not going to be the chairman of the Federal Reserve facing congressional opposition. Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary and former president of Harvard, took his name out of the running over the weekend. For an economic wonk, Summers is unusual. He's a pop culture figure who had a cameo in the movie Social Network as the prickly, outspoken Darth Vader to the Winklevoss twins.
I'm sorry, President Summers, but this isn't petty larceny. This idea is potentially worth millions of dollars.
Millions?
Yes.
You might just be letting your imaginations run away with you.
I honestly don't think you're in any position to make that call.
I was the U.S. Treasury Secretary. I'm in some position to make that call.
Central casting there. Larry Summers, played by actor Douglas Urbanski in The Social Network. With Summers out, other names being discussed include Janet Yellen, the current vice chairman of the Fed, or Timothy Geithner, former Treasury Secretary. The White House is said to be unexcited by Yellen, and Geithner has said he's unexcited by the job. Joining us now, Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC Radio. Charlie, welcome.
Hello.
And Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
Todd, does this mean that the president just really messed up here, that he didn't really understand what's going on with Congress to not have seen this Democratic opposition coming?
Well, John, it's not really clear what the president understood and didn't. It's been an entire summer of opposition to Larry Summers. It wasn't Republicans this time, it was progressives, liberal Democrats. You know, it was only really within the last week when it became obvious that Larry Summers was going to have real, real trouble getting confirmed in the Senate if President Obama appointed him. And that came when three senators voiced opposition directly against Larry Summers, John. Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Jeff Merkley, and Elizabeth Warren, the new senator from Massachusetts, all on the banking committee, all probably for slightly different reasons, opposing Larry Summers, you know, primarily because of some of his actions or perceived actions during the Clinton years.
Well, part of the issue here is that Larry Summers is known as the deregulation king during the Clinton administration, which set the stage, according to some of those senators that Todd mentioned, for the financial meltdown. And it was very, very clear, Charlie, that these hearings, these confirmation hearings, were going to be a chapter and verse revisit of the narrative of all the bankers that didn't get prosecuted, all of the things that didn't get done to deal with too big to fail, and that the administration just wasn't going to tolerate that.
And whether that's fair or not, I mean, his perspectives may have evolved since the late 90s. I mean, it has been 15 years or so since he espoused some of those different perspectives. And the other thing I would point out here, I think, which is really important, is the woman issue that's going on within the Obama administration, the sense that the administration has not done enough to really promote qualified women to higher positions. Mixed in with this, you now have Larry Summers, who had this issue when he was at Harvard about comments that he made about women. Whether they were taken out of context or sort of made worse than what he really said, you can argue about. But this woman gender issue comes up, and you have an extremely qualified woman who could be the Federal Reserve chairman. And just by the very fact that she's not close to Obama, doesn't get the job, this is an issue there as well, too, that the White House was fighting against.
Well, Summers is history at this point. The question is Janet Yellen, the number two at the Fed, going to be now the heir apparent? It certainly seemed that way when economics expert Pippa Malgren on this program talked about Janet Yellen.
Look, all presidents want to put their stamp on the Fed. That's normal. But in this case, I think that he believes that her softer stance on the economy is the right thing to do. And it happens that she's fully qualified and that she is also a woman. And all those things add up in a world where actually there aren't that many other great choices.
Todd Zwillick, Janet Yellen, although apparently not the favorite until Summers pulled his name out, now may be partly because she really passes muster with Republicans at this point and is more inclined to maintain the stimulus and keep this slow recovery going.
the White House, John, is really looking for a Fed chairman who won't just worry about the markets and the financial institutions, but will take on the role of keeping unemployment down. The president really, really wants Tim Geithner, former Treasury Secretary, who apparently has turned the job down several times and did so again last week. He's the real choice, but the president can't convince him. That's what we're being told. But Janet Yellen clearly is the high-profile choice now, and definitely the choice of progressive groups, of women's groups who were crowing yesterday and over the weekend and last night after Larry Summers pulled his name out of contention here.
But there's been such like a almost like a campaign that's been going on for this that's been much more public than we've really ever seen in the history of the Fed for who would become the chairman. You know, back in July, there were letters from about a third of the senators saying Yellen is the clear candidate. Just last week, we had over 350 economists write a letter to the Obama administration pushing for Yellen. And the worry is, does this backfire? Even if she didn't have anything to do with trying to get the position, does the president feel like, I'm being forced to choose this person who's not who I wanted, so I'm going to go somewhere else altogether?
Although this has been public really since Alan Greenspan left the scene, who's going to be the Fed chairman is a big deal
but
in Washington.
Open,
I'm wondering,
open political competing for
but
it.
But let's talk about that for a moment. What is the message to the markets with the debt ceiling debate going on, the government shutdown debate going on, and the confirmation of the Fed chairman all in play at the same time? Todd first and then Charlie.
John, what it projects is an extraordinary amount of uncertainty, which we all know is the one thing that the markets hate. The other issues on Capitol Hill that you talk about are not Democratic issues. These are Republican issues. And this goes back to 2010 and even a little bit before in terms of the dysfunction of Congress when it comes to debt and economic issues. But the debt limit and that issue, which is a much bigger issue for Wall Street, by the way, default and debt limit is much more serious than a piddling government shutdown. That issue is so far from solved, and the right is pushing John Boehner and Republicans so hard, it is unclear right at the moment how they get that issue solved. The markets hate that.
The immediate reaction from the markets at the news about Summers withdrawing his name is that they actually rose. And this is the belief that Summers would have come in and started to more aggressively in the recent policies of the Fed to get the economy going, and that Janet Yellen will keep them going longer. So, and the markets like this because it's easy money and it's keeping things flowing. So I think this uncertainty for right now, the markets are going to think it's Janet Yellen until it's not. And then they'll react.
Short-term positive, but the longer instability is the message from Washington, the more we have to worry. Charlie Herman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC Radio, and Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
You bet, John.
Coming up, your bicycle is destiny?
This is Tom. I'm calling from Nutley, New Jersey, and what my bike says about me is, well, judging by the amount of dirt and dust on the bike as well as the flat tires, I'd say I don't really have a lot of free time to ride my bike.
This is Elizabeth, and I'm calling from New York. My bike was just stolen from our front stoop, so I suppose it says I live in Brooklyn.
Bikeographies from you out there. What does your bike say about you? Mount Vernon, New York, you say, I am very careless because I left it outside a store for 5 minutes without locking it, and it was stolen. It's always 5 minutes, right? Walnut Creek, California, you say, my bike says I should ride it more or at least get a more comfortable seat for it. Whether you ride your bike or not, we're asking you to participate in the Takeaway Bike Challenge. Stay with us to learn how to participate or visit thetakeaway.org, you peddlers. Bike riders of Takeaway Nation, unite.
The world spins around.
Smoke gray, scratched all over.
Grumpy drivers, tense cyclists.
Bike wheels spin around the world.
Light for stairs and the subway.
We are better for it.
Can't we all just get along?
My bike does me right.
Let's get our feet on the poetic pedals, folks, and go biking. You know, the automobile and the bicycle came into being at nearly the same moment in human history. The car soon left the bicycle in its dust in many ways, but now the bicycle is piercing the smog of a century of car exhaust, nimbly negotiating traffic nightmares and laughing off parking problems, and benefiting from some very sophisticated technology to make a big urban comeback. We want to celebrate this renaissance, get you involved in our celebration, and take a serious look at bike sharing programs around the nation, all the while contributing, we hope, to peace between these slightly cocky resurgent cyclists and their beleaguered city drivers. Let's explore bike culture now with Adam Riley, reporter for WGBH News, Alex Goldmark, senior reporter right here at WNYC New York with Transportation Nation. And we begin with Joy Diaz, reporter from KUT Austin, Texas, who reports that Austin, while still without a bike share program, is part of the bike revolution. Joy Diaz, when did you first notice that bicycles are coming back?
I knew that bikes were coming back when Mexico City started using bikes, you know, when people in the most congested city started using bikes. And then I moved to Austin, and then it's like bike-loving culture on steroids. Oops, maybe we shouldn't use the word steroids.
Just don't enter the Tour de France. Adam Riley? Adam Riley, when did you first notice that something's going on?
I'm not sure if I picked up on it in Boston and the surrounding towns before we launched our big bike share program in 2011. But that was when I realized that this thing was sort of reaching some sort of critical mass in Boston.
And here in New York, Alex Goldmark, bike share is just one piece of this populist kind of bike transformation of the city that I think's changed a lot in this city.
I think it's changed the culture. Mayor Michael Bloomberg, when he came into office 12 years ago, he decided he wanted to change the culture, and he hired a transportation commissioner with a mandate to make the city more friendly to bikes and pedestrians, and that means sometimes a little less friendly to speeding cars. There have been 400 miles of new bike lanes added in the city in the past 12 years, and cycling is up 58% because of that. And now we're 4 months into our new city bike sharing program with 80,000 members already, and on some days 40,000 trips get taken on it.
So now Bloomberg wanted the city to be friendlier to bikes, right?
That's right.
But did he mandate that the bikers themselves be friendlier to pedestrians and cars?
Yeah. No.
A little stiffly.
But he may have had a conversation with the police chief, because there have been a few crackdowns.
But there's some sort of zen and the art of bicycle commuting in America going on here. I think that there's a quality of you say who you are on your bike, right? You do that, Alex.
I think my bike says something about me, and I think my bike commute is actually a calming time that forces me to focus. Otherwise, I get hit by a car.
Joy, how about you? Your bike experience says something about you, about your life?
I love the fact that there's a bike for everyone. You see moms with baskets and children, you know, riding bicycles that are safer. And then you see a lot of children going to school on their bikes. And then you see, of course, you know, the messengers and the really professional bikers. But it touches on how it talks about people. I think it's very real in Austin and the bike riding culture of Austin.
From Campagnolo to Hello Kitty. You can express
exactly
a fashion statement on your bike no matter what. Adam Riley, what is your bike experience, the color of your bike, the objects you carry on your bike say about you as a person?
Well, I have a bit of a confession to make here. Back when I was in graduate school several years ago, I biked a pretty good amount. Since then, I have aged, had kids, and now live in the suburbs. So I am a rare rider. I can handle riding up where I live, which is near the ocean, where there's some, you know, gorgeous pathways where you can ride without worrying about getting smacked by a car. I've done a little bit of riding on the hubway system in Boston. But honestly, despite the upsurge in ridership and despite structural things that the city has done to try to make Boston more hospitable to bikers, like adding, you know, bike lanes or bike tracks in some cases, riding around Boston, I think, is a really scary thing. The city is not laid out well, as a rule, for bikes and cars to share the streets. The roads are very narrow. And just so listeners know, my bike, which is, I'm afraid, sitting in a cellar with kind of flat tires right now, is an old Specialized, I think it's a Rock Hopper with some, you know, those really sleek tires that are horrible in wet weather, but allegedly are more efficient. So that's what I rode back in the day, and that's what I still have.
Well, there are bike shops there, within a block of you that can take care of that in probably an hour. What we want to do is to turn all of these statements, sort of personal statements, personal identity issues associated with biking and interacting with bikers into a, well, what else? A haiku contest, right?
That makes total sense to
me. Does that make total sense? My bike, let me tell you about my bike, all right? It's green. It's a three-wheel tricycle because I use a wheelchair and I can't pedal, but I can pedal with my hands. So I sit on a three-wheel bike where the chains are on the front tire. It's very impressive in traffic because people don't quite know what it is. They don't really understand. It doesn't look anything like a wheelchair. So here's my haiku. All right. And it's about my bike. And then we'll share yours here. Four wheels minus one, wrapped in oily chains, flying free over bridges. Yeah, there you go. Something like that. So do you get an image of me on the three-wheel bike? You know, there's chains everywhere, but I'm zooming across a Brooklyn Bridge.
I picture you zigging and zagging out of traffic, and I can see you just barely over the hood of a car, and I'm terrified.
Well, I've got a flag. I carry a flag. Otherwise, I'd be dead. That's for absolute sure. Joy, what'd you come up with?
Well, I came up with something more universal. The world spins around. Bike wheels spin around the world. We are better for it.
Oh. Nice. Nice.
Whether it's the first time you ride a bike or whether you are a longtime rider, the world is still better for it.
I love that. That's fantastic. We think of Alex Goldmark as a guy who gets up in the morning, does a couple of jumping jacks, writes a haiku, and then heads into WNYC Radio here. What'd you come up with,
That's Alex? Roughly right. And you inspired me in this interview, so I actually wrote a new haiku about my bike right here while we're on the air.
Goodness. Show off.
It is gray, scratched all over, light for stairs and the subway. My bike does me right.
Excellent. Very impressive. Very impressive. Adam Riley, now your bike's down in the basement with flat tires, yeah. But your mind is not.
Well, I guess my haiku reflects the somewhat nervous and anxious mindset regarding biking in Boston that I described earlier. So here it goes. Narrow streets, grumpy drivers, tense cyclists. Can't we all just get along?
A lot of people can relate to that.
That'll work on a poster.
All right. So since you guys are so enterprising and so great, we're going to make you the judges. Okay. Alex Goldmark, senior reporter for WNYC's Transportation Nation here in New York. Joy Diaz, reporter for KUT in Austin, Texas. And Adam Riley, reporter for WGBH News, is going to be the judges for the Takeaway Haiku Bike Riding Experience Challenge. Now, remember, haikus follow the 5-7-5 formula, one line of five syllables, second line seven syllables, third with five syllables. Our expert panel of judges will vote and select their top 10 picks. Winners will be getting prizes. So in order to submit your entry, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. Submissions are being accepted for 1 week, so you have from now until 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, September 22nd, to take part. Happy writing and riding, and keep these haikus, you know, really general. Is it about you? Is it about your experience? Is it about how you feel? Is it just something about what's going on in this world? Bikes are taking over in the beginning of this century. Our haiku challenge has now begun. Take your 17 syllables to thetakeaway.org to learn how to participate. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.